Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Fourth Age. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this time is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew, and hi, everybody listening. It's great to be here, as always, and with us also for this episode, for a short time anyway, is Carrie.
Hello, everybody. Yep, I'm going to be here for a little while, and then I'll have to duck out. But in the meantime, I'll be here to chat it up with everyone, and Spencer's with us.
Hey, everyone. It is great to be here this episode, and we're going to have a very interesting discussion going on this episode, but before we do that, before we hop right into it, we need to give you our customary spoiler warning. We have, collectively, we have read all of the current books in print of The Wheel of Time, including the prologue and the guide, and pretty much everything else we can get our hands on, because we're ravenous about this. We're absolutely Watt crazy.
Yoo-hoo!
So we will be discussing everything that we have read, which isn't always contained within the Wattosphere. Sometimes we go out and we spoil other stuff. We try not to, but every once in a while we do. But definitely there will be Wheel of Time spoilers in this podcast. If you have not read all of the books of the Wheel of Time, you may want to not listen to the podcast yet. Get through reading and then come back and listen. And then also we'll try and give you spoiler warnings if we go in and spoil something like the end of Harry Potter, which everyone should know by now anyway, but we'll give you a spoiler warning anyway.
So in this podcast, we have recently received an email from Patrick. Patrick says, Dear Fourth Age podcasters, I would love to see a discussion on the following observation I made on the three boys. All three of the main characters, Rand, Matt, and Perrin, are based very closely on Norse gods. Rand is based on Tyr, the god of justice. He uses a sword, only has one hand, and leads the fight against the giants at Ragnarok. Matt is based on Odin. Odin is often called Old One Eye, as he sacrificed one of his eyes. He wields a spear and often wears a wide-brimmed hat. He is associated with two ravens and is considered very tricky at times, as he likes to mess with others both physically and mentally. Odin was hung from the world tree Yggdrasil, and is also the bringer of the runes to man, which sort of parallels Matt's use of the old tongue. Perrin is based on Thor. Thor was the strongest of the gods, protector of the common man, and has a beard, as well as wields a magic hammer named Mjolnir. Thor is known as the destroyer of giants, which in my mind is similar to the Trollocs. I thought that this was very interesting and that you might be willing to discuss this in a future podcast. Thanks for considering, Pat.
First off, a big hand to Andrew Gellos for being able to pronounce all those Welsh words correctly.
Yeah, really.
I know there's no way I'd be able
to. No, me neither.
I particularly love the world tree, Yggdrasil. Yggdrasil.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Whoa.
And actually, we're kind of lucky. I almost slipped in and pronounced one of the other derivations of Odin's name while I was doing that as well, just because his name's gone through lots of iterations, depending on where you're coming from. And I think Tyr's name is also sometimes combined with a secondary piece. It's like a Hagatyr or something like that, depending on the age of the myth you're going from and the particular ethnic derivation.
I don't really know much on him, actually.
Yeah, I'm much in the same boat. I actually...
Obviously,
oh, sorry,
Odin.
Go ahead, Kier.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying that I don't... You know, Odin and Thor are obviously, like, very well-known. Just I think everybody probably just knows their names, just to... Even if they don't know much about them, but... Yeah, so I'm kind of unfamiliar with, at least that I can think of right now, because I probably, you know, did do some of it school, but my brain's just not going back that far, so.
Yeah, I know. I'm much in the same boat. You know, I know the names of Odin and Thor, and I even recognize the name of Tyr somewhat, but the actual stories of these Norse gods, I don't know. However, because I found this email interesting enough that I wanted to look deeper into it, you know, the first place I went and checked was the 13th Depository, which is a Wheel of Time. Well, it's called the 13th Depository. It's an absolute depository of all sorts of in-depth observations into varying aspects of the Wheel of Time, you know, including the outfits that they wear, some of the other customs, even in-depth analysis of the minor characters. But the pages that I looked for were the character parallel pages that Linda, who runs the 13th Depository, has put together. For those of you playing along at home who would like to follow along with the information that I at least am going to be looking at for a lot of this podcast, and I think maybe some of the others are too, you can find those at 13thdepository.blogspot.com. And so, you know, for a lot of these, in fact, for all three of the boys, I went and I looked up what she had on them for each of the three different gods that Patrick brought up, just so I can know a little bit more. And it's quite interesting. But rather than my untrained self going, we should have Andrew go first, because he seems to actually know a little bit of Norse mythology.
I don't necessarily know that I would say I know a good deal. Amongst my many hobbies is poking through mythologies and various other things. The Norse mythology is a little complex. As a matter of fact, it's kind of odd. You'll get a lot of conflicting reports on various things. Like in Tyr's case, for example, he in a number of places predates Odin as the head or the patriarch of the pantheon. And then he either steps aside or is somehow, you know, supplanted by Odin, even though at some point he's considered both older than Odin and Odin's son. It ends up getting into like the Egyptian mythology where Anubis being older than Osiris is sometimes considered Osiris's son. And basically, you have a lot of varying early mythologies that end up clashing with each other timeline-wise. And overall, there's a lot just in general. When I originally read this email, I had completely forgotten that Odin had been hung from the world tree, which was also a kind of tree of life, although he kind of did that voluntarily, if I remember properly. A lot of Odin's antics as far as losing his eye and being hung were all things he did in order to gain knowledge and magic and power in order to be able to do the things that he does. And you'll see him in a lot of places. He was actually probably one of the fairly large components in developing the imagery for Gandalf the Grey, with his, you know, wide floppy hat and his long gray beard and everything like that. Because as I look through different things, I'm kind of surprised where people keep coming up. And I think in the last podcast we recorded, I had mentioned that Tyr, having sacrificed his right hand, I think it's his right hand, it doesn't matter. He sacrifices a hand in order to ward away Fenrir, the giant wolf of essentially doom. I found that kind of interesting. But if you look back at a lot of mythologies and a lot of any sort of fictional series where a person loses a hand, a lot of times it's an unconscious reference back to Tyr, including all those people who lose a hand and then have it replaced with an artificial one of either silver or gold.
Or Star Wars type prosthetic.
Exactly.
Well, I think it was interesting, too, that you mentioned Fenrir. Got a crossover to Harry Potter there. Remember the werewolf Fenrir Greyback?
Mm-hmm.
Blatant.
Well, and we were talking before the podcast started up. The three boys actually end up being kind of a melding of various different gods. Matt is very, at least figurally, a parallel to Odin. There are some other aspects in combination with Hugin and Munin, Odin's two ravens. Odin was also associated with wolves as well. So, you know, you get a little bit of Perrin in there. And while Perrin is rather burly and bearded, as we see with Thor, Thor's coloration is, you know, he's tall, fair of skin, with, you know, red hair and often very light-colored eyes, which, you know, bleeds over into Rand. There's actually a lot of crossover when you take, you know, mythological imagery. And, you know, and we've kind of discussed this in other places. We've mentioned how the, you know, the Draugr are, you know, somewhat based on, you know, old, you know, vampire and, you know, succubus, incubus type stories and fictions. So there is a lot. And actually, I'd be interested to see if we could find more references the further we went on. I keep wanting to look for some way to connect Padden Fain to something anywhere. And as much as I want to say, you know, that he's a kind of Loki type person, he really doesn't fit any of the Loki profiling at all.
That would be cool if somebody
thought of
anything.
I have to admit that I am not up enough on Norse mythology to really be much of a contributor to this one. It sounds like Andrew's really in his view, but
I'm trying to find a making, just because Ma'alianir is in there. Kind of interesting that the enchanted hammers are both beginning with M's and ending in IR.
Yeah. Well, the other one, I don't know how you pronounce it, like it's Mjolnir or something like that, Mjolnir.
Yeah, Mjolnir. Essentially. Yeah. And I'm probably doing that incorrectly as well. Where are you? We're one of my favorite chapters in this freaking book.
Which one? The making?
You don't have a dog-eared yet?
No, I don't quite abuse my books the way I should.
Yeah, that's one of the saddest things in the world is a well-cared-for book. Because you know, if it's well-cared-for, it's not being used properly.
I like keeping my books in nice, good condition.
I do too. I do too. They're safe in my drawer right now.
Ma'alianir. There we go. I was also trying to, actually, easier way. Yay, Wikipedia. Norse mythology.
Yes.
Having a reference point is probably.
Go to Wiki. When in doubt, go to Wiki.
And of course, that's an actual good one too. Out of the Norse mythology, the Alfhimir and the world of the Alfar, or the elves.
Uh-oh.
Very much like the Eilfen.
No, don't do it! Kidding.
Of course, their counterparts, the black elves, were the Svartalfarnir. Svartalfarnir. Voltalfheim.
Okay.
And of course, you know, we have the, on the Norse mythology and that, the Jormungard, or the Jormungand, the world serpent.
Yeah, the sea serpent. Is it the world serpent? Is that actually?
Yeah, it encircles the world, and if I remember properly, is eating its own tail.
Like the Ouroboros?
Yep.
Doesn't it get killed by Thor, though?
Oh, yeah. Part of Ragnarok.
So you're telling me Perrin's going to kill the...
Yes, Perrin is going to kill Time.
The Serpent of Time. Okay, cool.
No, because Jormungar and Thor kill each other, right?
Yeah.
So wouldn't it make more sense for that to be Rand?
Yeah, probably. Who knows? Now, the thing is, I want to wait. I'm waiting since, obviously, you know, Odin's connections with, you know, Jerry and Freki, the wolves, you know, obviously bleeds over into Perrin and that. I really gotta wonder which of the boys is gonna get Sleipnir, Odin's eight-legged horse.
Oh, that's Bella, obviously.
Bella barely has four legs, let alone eight.
I wanna see who gets this, pronounce the squirrel's name. Yeah.
Ratha Oskra. Oh, it's living in Ruadine, apparently.
Yeah, it's in the branches of the Tree of Life. This is interesting, though. The artistic mastery is more interesting here of how good Robert Jordan is at writing these things. I mean, we're going back to Odin. When he gave up his eye, it says, and I'm reading off the wiki page now. It says, Odin, the chief god, appraised of what is happening on Earth since he gave an eye to the well of Mimir.
Yeah,
the well of Mimir in his quest for wisdom. I think it's interesting, you know, we know that for Matt, you know, he had to give up his eye to the Finn. Which Finn did he give it to? The Elfin? I don't know. One of the two. I think it's interesting when we think of not Matt so much, but the story of Brigitte. The story Brigitte told when she had to go into the world of the Finn to try and save Gaidalf. When she goes into the world of the Finn, I mean, the story becomes later that she's looking for a fountain of life. I think it's interesting the connection between well and fountain, because the only difference between the two is one you have to pull the water up, the other it's already there. I don't know. Just a tip of the hat to the mastery that with which Jordan could craft his world. The idea that the idea of the Finn's gifts, either of knowledge or life or truth or whatever, the idea of that as water, which is kind of the tie-in between the two. It made more sense in my head, I swear.
Well, in some cases, Matt's journey is really interesting when you parallel it with Odin, because Odin more than once makes a sacrifice in order to, as I kind of said earlier, to gain power and knowledge, which are basically all about, and you know, preservation of essentially the Norse pantheon. And Matt, in a way, ends up making those same sorts of sacrifices. You know, he's really, all of his interactions with the Finn, except that very first time, was all about making, you know, essentially sacrifices in order to better or, you know, essentially save the world. You know, he ends up gaining knowledge, which is kind of why he went into the doorway in Ruadin. He went in looking for more answers. He went in for knowledge. And he ended up getting hung for it, which is really kind of ironic and funny.
Unless you're Matt. I don't think Matt thought it was really amusing.
Well, no, probably not.
It's really amazing the number of cultures that they actually drew from to do some of these crossovers, though. It's just, you know, he was obviously quite a scholar. More than I am, that's for sure.
No, you know, I was thinking about Thor and Heron, but then how earlier Andrew, I think it was before we were recording, was saying how some of the things just don't mesh up, which is true, and it does seem almost like Thor is like a combination of Heron. Obviously, everyone knows Thor and his hammer and all that, so it's almost like some of it, though, went to Rand as well. Not all, I guess maybe not a whole bunch of it, but it's like the... I don't know, because Thor strikes people down with lightning or something like that, right? Sorry, I'm not really up on my Norse mythology. I'm trying to remember, like...
Thor, he was kind of... he was a protector of mankind. He was the god of thunder, lightning, storms. And, you know, he bleeds through into everywhere in society. You know, obviously the Asgard show up as the, you know, Roswell Gray aliens in the Stargate series.
I was just thinking that about Thor from the Asgard.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
obviously any sort of fantasy based, you know, video game or role playing game has a variant in which there is a, you know, strong hammer wielding god that hurls lightning bolts. I mean, it happens everywhere.
Yeah.
And you can pick them out all over the place. Incidentally, I was also just thinking, you know, it's coming up as a movie relatively soon.
Yeah.
And, you know, Thor even makes an appearance, you know, essentially as himself in Avatar form, in the Marvel universe. And Thor. I was never so excited, I think, as when I was in the theater watching Iron Man 2 on opening night, and it rolls to the end of the credits, and there's a giant smoking crater with a hammer at the bottom of it, and I was like, yes, we're getting Thor! a wonderful geek moment there. I almost said Greek moment. Yes, Thor, the Greek god of Norse thunder.
Yeah.
Wait. Wait, what?
Yeah.
Oh, let's not get into Greek parallels, please. Oh, my, we'll be here all day or all night, depending on when you're listening to this.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, no Greek.
Thor bears at least 14 different names.
Really? Does he?
Uh-huh. Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah, you know, because, yeah, actually.
Well, then they got that one wrong. He is the husband of golden-haired goddess Sif, is the lover of Jotun, Jarnsaxa, and is described as a fierce-eyed, red-haired, and red-bearded. Or with Sif, Thor fathered the goddess. Oh, God, I'm not even going to bother saying that. That's written in characters I can't read.
So,
not runes or anything?
Definitely in characters that are foreign even to my widely read eyes.
Oh, man, yeah, good gosh.
Yeah, I know. You saw that, did you?
Yeah. Wow, that's not any modern English. That's very nice. But I have to wonder, do you think that this, I'm just going to say Mui. I'm just going to say Mui, because that's as close as we can get with the characters we know. But do you think that this Mui and Urler, I don't know,
Urler.
do you think either of them might have ties into Rand's twins?
Hmm.
Okay, I don't know who you're talking about. I'm lost on that one.
These are the children of Thor. Well, one's the child of Thor, the other one's the stepchild of Thor. Oh, here we go. Oh, Moody.
But they're not twins. They're just...
This is interesting.
I don't know anything about
Moody
them.
And Mangi are the sons of Thor. Their names mean angry and strong, respectively. Someone states that along with Thor's daughter, another not-American characters, but whose name means strength, they embody their father's features. This might actually be closer to Avienda's children than to Elaine. I don't know. It's interesting. Of course, if we wanted to delve into that, we'd have to delve into Avienda's visions a lot more, and I don't want to do that right now. My head hurts enough.
See, and I'm kind of interested, you know, we kind of come into different things, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, well, you know, if we're pairing the Norse gods with the three boys, then there's a small pairing of, you know, Ragnarok to the last battle.
Definitely, yeah.
And in order for that to happen, Baldur has to die. And now I'm wondering who Baldur is supposed to be within the various...
What now?
Right.
Thor's brother, and if I remember properly, one of Odin's sons, his name is Baldur, and he's essentially, like, the god of peace, if I remember properly. See if I can pull that up really quickly.
God of Peace sounds like a tinker. Oh, here he is, Baldur. That list.
Yep.
Okay.
Or he was just... He was especially... From what I remember is that he was the best of the gods. Like, he was just one of the most honorable that there was, and he ends up... Like any good heroic character that can only be killed by one thing, it should be noted that if you are in fiction of any sort and you have only one weakness as a hero or a villain, doesn't really matter, but particularly with heroes, you are fated to encounter and be killed by that one thing.
Yay, kryptonite.
Achilles,
yeah.
Arrow to the ankle.
Yep.
Oh, darn, dead. Baldur,
yep.
Sprig of holly. I mean, come on. I think it was holly. Holly or mistletoe?
This
I want to say holly.
That's very interesting. So we want to think about characters in the story that are seen by pretty much everyone as peaceful peoples. You know, the best of that humanity has to offer, pretty much. I'm thinking, strangely enough, sadly enough, I'm thinking Tam. But who... Yeah. Tam Al Thor.
Okay.
But And then when they die, it's probably going to be by poison, which of course will tick Nynaeve off. Why couldn't I tell? I should have been able to tell that was... Anyway.
And then Egwene will say, yes, you should have been able to because you used to drone on and on about herbs.
Yeah. Shut up!
So, incidentally, now that I have been refreshed by the wonders of the internet...
Yay, Wiki.
Baldur had a dream that he would die, and his mother shared that particular dream. Since the dreams in Norse mythology were usually prophetic, then he became depressed, and his mother, Frigga, made every object on Earth vow never to hurt Baldur. All objects made this vow except mistletoe. Frigga thought it too unimportant and non-threatening to bother asking it to make the vow. And as a result, of course, that is the one thing that would end up hurting him. And then, of course, Loki decided he's going to make himself a spear or an arrow or some sort of implement from that particular plant. And, of course, it ends up killing Baldur, which kicks off the chains that lead to Ragnarok.
Oh, well then, we don't necessarily need to worry about it because the last battle's already coming. If it was Baldur's death that started the chain reaction, we don't need to worry about that.
True. I mean,
I didn't mean to cut you off, but I'm looking again at Baldur's wiki page and there's an interesting inscription. What is this? Odin's last word to Baldur from 1908 by someone's calling wood. It's interesting because it's a funeral ship with sorrowful women standing over it.
That is true.
I mean, there's four women, and then there's also a guy crouched over talking to whoever's lying in the funeral ship. And it's not quite a pyre because it's a ship. That is very interesting. Very interesting to note.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, I mean, obviously, there's not a direct parallel. Robert Jordan would not have been the great fiction author he was if this were just a retelling of any one or even multiple mythologies all scrunched together. I mean, that's not how, you know, the act of storytelling works. It is really neat to see when you get certain parallels. Because obviously, if we're going to go back to the three boys, Thor probably never, and I mean, definitely never in anything that I've seen, but probably I'm really doubting you're ever going to get a story in the Norse mythology that, you know, refers to Thor questioning whether or not he can lead people. And it's like Perrin's personality very obviously is not Thor.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the first things I thought, actually.
Although I will also say in a few versions of things I have seen that have referenced Odin, including Neil Gaiman's American Gods, which is a wonderful, if extremely coarse-languaged fictional account, Odin was quite the ladies' man a lot. And in that way, you know, he kind of mimics Zeus out of the Greek pantheon at times. But it seems really interesting that, you know, Matt gets paired up with Odin, who also kind of has an eye for the ladies.
Mm-hmm.
Although he's been very good since he got married.
Well, yeah.
He's certainly trying.
Well, yes, because that girl would be great for Tolanus.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, maybe Tom or Vanna.
He just has to look for his friends, you know. He can't just stop looking and not think of them, you know. He has to
So he's turned from a roving eye rogue to a pimp for his friends. I don't know if I like that all that much, you know. It's not that cool, actually.
Well,
it's not Matt-like either.
No, he's just looking for himself, but. You know, you have to come up with a good excuse not to.
Yeah, right.
Or what? Why?
It is very Matt-like, you know? When he gives his word, he very much sticks to it. And he gave his word that he married that woman. And to him, it means obviously something completely different than it means to her, because especially marriages of high-ranking members of the government mean very little besides the fact that, oh, yes, they are bound together, sort of.
Yeah. Political.
But, yeah, basically political in nature. But to him, it's something very serious. And so it's changed him a little bit.
Oh, he's definitely going to take it seriously because he would never, you know, it's Matt. But,
well,
I mean, he's still
I'm not
going
to moon over her. Yeah. I'm not going to moon over her. I'm going to live my life. I wonder how she's doing. Is she good? Did she get back safe? I mean, yeah.
Tulane definitely grew on him.
So why do you think, apparently, all through known or whatever, how much of it is known, or tradition or oral history or whatever that goes on through the turnings of the wheel and rounds world, why do you think Robert Jordan chose to pick three manifestations of the Light's champion this time instead of just one, which is apparently the way it's pretty much always been? I mean, there wasn't anybody sitting down telling him that he had to make parallels with Norse gods in order to tell his story.
And he originally had four. So I just wonder what traits these guys picked up that weren't originally theirs and they were this other guy, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I kind of think of that sometimes. I just wonder, like,
I do remember reading about that recently, sort of like the fourth Beatle.
Yeah.
Or the fifth Beatle, I should say. There were four. Never mind.
It just kind of makes you wonder, like, if there's certain personality traits or certain things that happen to each individual guy and three, Matt Pat, Matt, Perrin, and Rand, if, you know, certain ones were supposed to originally be this other guy. I don't think we ever knew his name. Did we know his name? No, because some people say maybe he was, they guessed with different people, but,
Erwin Fingar or whatever.
Yeah, a lot of people think he was him, yeah.
Yeah.
Which if it was, I'm certainly glad they decided to drop him out.
Yeah. There was somebody else, too, that was mentioned as a possibility.
Maybe Will. Mm-hmm. Elfine, or?
Oh, that would have been really painful.
Yeah, because they definitely weren't, might have put a different little loop in with their interactions, though, but.
So the fourth one actually ended up to be Egwene.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
But I like that there's three of them, and that it's not, even though Rand is more of the, obviously, the one that's going to have to follow through, and supposedly it's all him. Everyone thinks he's thinking like it's all on him, but we know, or we think we know, or at least I think, that it's Matt and Perrin are going to play a lot larger role than it's just all Rand doing it, right? So I don't know what gave him that idea, but I like that he did it because it just makes things so much more interesting than it's just one guy against,
everybody else, pretty much.
Yeah. I really like that, the way he did that.
I was really taken with the section in the Towers of Midnight where Matt just lost his eye to the Elfin, Matt has just lost his eye to the Elfin, and the one that they're all, you know, swooning basically from the overload of sensory input or whatever it is that they're getting out of it, and they're sort of crying out little details of what they think, and the one is saying, they're all going on about the Saber. Oh, it's so strong, and how it twists around and how it spins. I can taste fate itself, and the gambler becomes the center of all. What's that exactly? I mean, how important is Matt's role going to be?
I know it makes you think that it's a lot larger than anything that we've had any hint to, you know?
Yeah. And clearly, Perrin, I mean, I sort of figured of any of the three boys that Perrin was basically the weakest, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, the weakest link or whatever, I don't know, he just seemed almost like an afterthought to me. And I mean, I did like the vision of him leading, you know, an endless line of wolves to the last battle, and I thought that's pretty much going to be his part, but now all of a sudden he's become totally made of awesome, you know, with the hammer and, you know, the abilities and the wolf dream and everything. He's just gone from, you know, emo Perrin to super Perrin. And Matt seems like he's poised for a similar sort of, you know, jump up, and, you know, Matt's going to do some serious leveling up here, I guess. I don't know. It's kind of fun, really, but it's scary in a way. I mean, as much as I've been reading this series over the last, you know, almost 20 years, I just can't fathom exactly where some of this is going. And we've only got one book left to wrap it up. So I guess that's why I'm not a fantasy writer and Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson are.
Yeah. You know, I think we got our biggest clue to what we have to look forward to from Farron. And I'm pretty sure it was to Egwene right before she died, is that the last battle is not going to be fought in the way that Randall Thor assumes.
Yeah.
And I know that from the time that we've spent in Rand's head, I kind of assumed at the very least the same thing, that it's going to be this massive epic battle for the fate of the world, you know, the side of the light against the side of the dark, clashing it out, and whoever wins, they win. But, you know, this line from Varen just bugs at me. It kind of digs in at my psyche, because, well, if it's not going to be fought that way, then how is it going to be fought?
Yeah. Well, you know, my crazy theory, I think that Rand is horrified at the idea that he'll be the one to break the world. He can't stand it. He just has always hated that, and I'm sure it's no different now that he's, you know, uber Zen Rand or whatever he is. So I've always just kind of had the thought that he's going to end up taking it purposefully into Teler Anriad and do most of the fighting there. And I don't see why he couldn't open a gateway and take Matt and Perrin with him if that worked out, that they're all together at that part of the last battle.
Well, that would be cool if they were.
But I can definitely see an epic scene, you know, where, you know, Matt, Rand, and Perrin are basically, you know, covering each other's backs and dealing out massive amounts of damage in their various different ways. If it'll happen like that, I'm probably just, you know, Varen would probably mock me too. I'm just as wrong as Rand's uncle.
But I can't see Rand and the Dark One, or whatever, after he breaks the seals, you know, is the Dark One going to, like, take form, some type of shape, or what's he going to do? Like, snatch a body like he does for the Forsaken, you know? I'm just kind of... And then I don't know.
That's what he's got Shida Haran for, doesn't he?
Yeah,
physical manifestation of the Dark One there.
Yeah.
Well, the thing we got to remember about the breaking of the seals, though, is that between the time that Mirren drilled the bore and the time that it was sealed by the 100 Companions, the Dark One had, you know, access to the world. He could touch the world directly. There was nothing stopping him. I mean, we've been told that since then, he's widened the bore, so he might be able to influence it more than he could. But from Rand's memories of that time, what were they able to do even when the Dark One could touch the world? I mean, they were still planting crops and singing to them. They could still carry on most of their daily lives as they were fighting. I mean, it's not like the Dark One could just sweep in and destroy everything. So I don't know, even with a wider bore, I don't know how he would be able to do that now if he couldn't do it before.
I don't know. It really, a lot of the conversations that Shamiel, Balzamon, Morden have lead me to believe that, first of all, I think he's been lying to Rand all along, that, you know, that it's been this big drag out, and a lot of times the Shadow has won and everything. I think that's pretty much mostly a lie. We don't really have any knowledge among the people of Randland of any of the other legends apart from the Age of Legends and the Breaking of the World.
We've heard some of Tom's stories that seem to have come from a world that would have been very similar to the one we're living in, which we know would have had to have happened before the Age of Legends. Because I'll let you in on a little secret here, folks. We ain't living in the Age of Legends.
Nope.
No,
but we might be living in the time of Murk and Moss curdling spears of fire at each other across continents and, you know, Mater Therese, mother of the wondrous inn. That was pretty obvious, Mater Therese, you know, hello, Mother Teresa, you know, and, you know, the great Elspeth, queen of all, you know, Queen Elizabeth. There's a lot of parallels. So, yeah, I think that should technically...
Oh, yeah.
Our podcast should be called The Second Age, probably, or First Age, depending on... Well, not the Second Age, because that was the Age of Legends. It's the Third Age is the one we're in now.
Right.
So, yeah, we would have been the First Age.
First Age.
I like to think of us as the Seventh Age, actually. But that's beside the point.
But I don't know how long people can really...
Theory.
I don't know how long people can really retain memories. I don't think it can cross over more than... I would be surprised if it crossed over more than, you know, one breaking or end of an age, let alone two or three.
Yeah. You know, I think... You know, that's one of the major plot points of the Wheel of Time. That's why it's called the Wheel of Time, because time goes, you know, in a circle. We have these stories from Tom indicating, and other things that, other artifacts that exist indicating that our world, where we live now, is sometime in the past for the Randlandians, the Third Agers, however you want to describe them. I'm going to say Third Agers. I think Third Agers works best. No. But also we have what we're going over right now, the character parallels from our past, you know, the Norse mythology as well as other parallels, indicating that the story that we're reading has been kind of diluted and changed to become our own mythologies that we have. And you know what? I'm just going to do a quick check real quick. I think I have a feeling that most of the parallels that are in the 13th depository here are probably European and Native American in origin, but I would be really interested to see if there are any tie-ins to Asian mythologies, especially Chinese.
Well, the dragon.
Oh, I know that they do. Yeah, the dragon, and I know that she also pulls out Buddha for Rand.
Mm-hmm. I will say, since we are, you know, speaking about the 13th depository and the wonderful, wonderful amount of information, I mentioned last recorded episode about the various plants and the heartleaf tea and where it was referenced and what plant it probably was derived from. All of this was recorded in the 13th depository under Rand. Specifically in Tyr, and bringing us back to what Patrick was talking about, Robert Jordan said at a book signing that he deliberately made Rand like Tyr. Rand is a fearsome fighter and an upholder of the law. He seeks to make a truce with the Shanchan so that they can combine forces for the last battle. In Knife of Dreams, a plain wooden box, he sacrificed his left hand to protect men from Semarog's attack. However, unlike the myths surrounding Tyr and the loss of his hand, it was Semarog who placed an unbreakable restraint upon Rand rather than he upon her, and only by drawing upon the true power through his link to Moradin was he able to escape the Quendiar Adam, which I found interesting. I didn't think about the fact that the black set of bracelets and that might have been some form of Quendiar, which makes it really creepy that it was shatterable with the true power. And then it also mentions that Tyr carries a spear that is less a weapon, but more a sign of judicial power. This is the equivalent, many people have said, to the dragon scepter, which was destroyed by Semarog's fireball.
Well, so going back to our original topic of how the three boys were based apparently on so much Norse mythology, what can we derive from, you know, the way the last battle is going to go from Norse mythology, Ragnarok? I mean, do you see parallels there? Is that going to hold up? I mean, or is it just, I mean, oh, he would pick and choose from a lot of different mythologies. This one seems to be really strongly entwined with the three boys. And then the other question I have, which don't let me forget, is how do the three girls figure into that? There really isn't anything like that in any mythology that I know of.
Oh, I'm sure if we went and looked, she would have. In fact, I'm going to do it right now. I'm going to just randomly, I'm just going to type Elaine right here.
I'm going to do an episode just with all different kinds of...
Assuming I can spell Elaine correctly. Someone spell Elaine for me, because I apparently can't spell it.
Yellow. A, maybe,
Y-N-E,
yeah.
Yes.
I did spell it right. Okay, she might not have one. You keep talking amongst yourselves. I'm going to look this up to see if she does have it here somewhere. I just am too stupid to find it.
I was looking rather quickly through the
various mythological parallels that the 13th depository draws to Matt. It is actually interesting because they don't really tie. There's a very, very small section in which they mention his connection to Odin. Actually, let's look in here. It actually comes in the section under the Hanged Man, which is the tarot symbol, which has a certain equivalent. But then in his second encounter with the Ilfin, Matt knowingly sacrificed an eye as payment to rescue Moraine, who was crucial for Rand's success. The Norse had a one-eyed god who sacrificed himself in many ways to gain knowledge, this being Odin.
And going back to your tarot thing here, the Hangman, is also called the Fool in some decks, and the Dark Prophecy at the very end of Towers of Midnight refers to Matt as the One-Eyed Fool. What was it, the Walking the Halls of Mourning or something, as in Gree, not Dawn?
The 13th Depository quoting goes on to say, from the earliest times, Odin was a war god, and he appeared in heroic literature as a protector of heroes, fallen warriors, then joined him in Valhalla, which, if we take an extreme stance on that, kind of ties towards the Horn of Valir and the dead heroes who then, you know, come back.
Right. Yeah.
In order to fight in the last battle. It actually says that the warriors who joined him in Valhalla did so that they could prepare for Ragnarok, which was the end of the Norse world. He was usually depicted wearing a cloak and a wide-brimmed hat and carrying a spear, which always struck its target. Odin rode an eight-legged horse and led the wild hunt across the sky. Matt being a very skillful, you know, this again parallels Matt's very skilled with horses. He's, you know, always, I mean, he has a dead eye, you know, he doesn't miss his target. And yeah.
Even when he's just randomly throwing knives, he hits the friggin', anyway.
Yeah, and puts a knife behind his back and gets a rabbit.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
And if you kind of, and if you think about it, the Horn of Valir has that kind of secondary, it is very similar to both, you know, at least the beginning and the kind of phonetic quality of Valkyrie, Valhalla, you know. And I just thought about this, the inscription on Matt's spear, and oh, hey, look, the 13th Depository also mentions this. What's written on the haft of Matt's spear is, thus is our treaty written, thus is our agreement made. Thought is the arrow of time, and memory never fades. That or what is asked is given, and the price is paid. The blade is marked with two ravens, and Odin's ravens, Hugin and Munin, are thought and memory.
Oh, ooh, I never got that. That went right over my head. That's very good.
That is good. I forgot all about Valhalla
that
too, because that's
so RJ.
Like, wow.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's so much like the Heroes of the Horn, and you know, just it. Wow, very cool.
What were the names for the ravens again?
Hugin and Munin.
Maybe Matt and Chuan can name their first kids that. Huh?
Yeah.
I have a fond spot for Odin's ravens because of Neil Gaiman's American Gods. The main character of which, Shadow, has an encounter with a raven during a portion of the novel. And without saying too much, he, in a fit, because, I mean, he up to this point, he hasn't really been amazingly believing in everything that's been happening to him. It's, you know, his mind is kind of slightly crushed by what's gone on. In sheer desperation at some point in time, he looks up at this raven who has just aided him and says, hey, Hugin or Munin or whatever your name is. And the bird looks at him and Shadow looks at the raven and says, say nevermore. And then the raven cusses him out and flies away. And it just, I will always remember that. It's just, hey, say nevermore.
Bleep! That's pretty good.
You know, I think that's actually, I think that I actually remember reading that part before I got fed up with the novel and stopped reading it.
Hmm.
Oh, I have it, but I haven't read it yet. It's on here, waiting. But I have to go now.
Oh.
Okay. Thanks,
right.
thanks for joining
but, me. Yeah, I got some extra time in because they went out for dinner, so.
Ah, that worked.
I knew it.
Yeah. Well, we had you for an hour and a half of recording time anyway.
I know, that's crazy. That's good, though. Yeah. Okay. Well, I will talk to you guys probably next week.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
It's interesting. We only had three Norse gods directly mapped to the three boys. And yet, Matt also has, you know, a combination in, or has a connection to another Norse god, that being Heimdall. Heimdall was notorious for drinking too much mead. He is the one who will blow the horn, Gjallarhorn, as Ragnarok, the end of the world, draws near, calling the gods and also the dead heroes who have been spending their time in Valhalla to the battlefield. Heimdall, interestingly enough also, and his enemy Loki, will kill each other at Ragnarok, having already fought over the goddess Freya's Birisingamen necklace, which Loki stole from Heimdall, confiscated, and returned to Freya. And that's just kind of interesting because we know for a fact at the moment that there are multiple copies of Matt's necklace out there, but Matt's necklace is the only one that is 100% foolproof, according to what we know in the story. And the idea that there might be yet another kind of anti-Matt out there who could be, you know, interested in obtaining Matt's necklace would be an interesting thing that I could see cropping up very easily, particularly...
With David Hanlon?
Yes.
Yeah, because he's already got one copy of it, and he certainly now would be interested in getting the original.
Mm-hmm.
And he's certainly an anti-Matt in a lot of ways.
I always thought the antithesis of Matt would be Fane, though.
Which
in
is
a lot of ways, dagger.
Possible as well. And, Fane, as far as we know, can probably still be killed by the One Power. If by some chance he learns about Matt's necklace, I could see that being a kind of thing that Fane would try to go after.
Well, I've often wondered why he didn't make... I know he has to go after Rand and he's obsessed with Rand, but he can track all of the boys, but I would think it'd be even easier for him to track Matt since Matt carried the dagger for so long and the chain is linked to the dagger. You'd think it would be really easy for him to find Matt, but he hasn't really made any effort in that direction.
I don't try and comprehend broken minds that are filled with nothing but crazy. So, you know, it's interesting though, back to the idea of Heimdall. And that he will blow the horn. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the name of the horn, though. But that Valhalla is meant to be not only at the top of the world tree, but also in a different world. And we know that the heroes of the horn spend their time, you know, waiting out, sitting out in Teleronriad, waiting for the last battle.
Yeah?
Go on. Expound on my idea. I'm just tying things together. I'm gonna shut up now.
So is Teleronriad like the most boring place in the world to wait out the centuries until the last battle, or is it the party place of the universe? And they can make anything they want happen there, right?
I mean, if you're one of the heroes of the horn in that, if Teleronriad ends up being something like Valhalla, I mean, you have everything you want. You can you can drink and eat and fight until you're content. And then when the horn blows, it's like, hey, off to the last battle, rock on.
And we've seen from the Great Hunt that the heroes of the horn, when they're called via the Horn of Valir, they still retain some of their strange otherworldly abilities. I mean, we saw Brigitte riding across a lake or riding across the water, and her arrows caught the boat instantly on fire. So,
which is a tie-in very closely to the Valkyrie.
Totally apropos of nothing. I'm wondering why, if we've got the people from Eridamon or Damani, and the people from Kandor are Kandori, why are the Andorans Andorans and not Andori?
Well, because they're from further south.
Oh, that's it.
Exactly.
And it sounds that the same reason the Tyrs are Tyrin and the
Tyrin, yeah.
Tyrin, however you want to say it. And that one place where Rand is king. Good gosh.
Ilion.
Good freaking heck. This is how bad it is. The only thing I could bring to mind was Isengard. Yeah.
Ilioners.
Yeah, the Ilioners.
Yeah. And the people from Mayen or Mayeners.
Yeah, but they're Domani from Eridomen, which is
pretty
farther south. So it's
That's not very consistent. That's okay. Random thought.
Just what sounds better. I mean, Andorian sounds weird. Andori, cheery.
Whatever.
Ilian-y.
Well, you know, that's kind of like, you know, one of our previous podcasts when we got into the discussion of the old tongue, the language of the modern common language was referred to by the person who asked the question as Randlandian, And I just like the term Randish better. I think it sounds better as a language.
It's like Entish.
Boorah-room.
Boorah-room-bah-room. Oh, dear. All right. Well, getting back
the trees.
On topic.
The tree.
What about, how come the yeah, they were kind of like the ants, but they didn't lose their ant wives. They still have them.
Just shows you
no,
that the ants,
mesh,
the ants, that's true. The green man really is more of an ant.
Yeah.
And he didn't just lose the ant wives, he lost to all of his people.
Yeah, they all died except for him. Were there any female Nim?
I imagine there had to have been.
No, they could just sprout. They don't necessarily have to procreate.
Well, they
I
were
think
constructs.
Shemeshta was kind of, yeah, I think they were kind of asexual. But
not
I don't know
them.
That for a fact.
Yeah,
I mean,
either.
He is the green man. I don't know if they actually were all male.
So why, if the Nim were construct and the mm-hmm. Ogier developed naturally, why do the Ogier look up to the Nim? You would think if they were just created and developed by Aes Sedai in the Age of Legends that they would have been maybe looked down on somewhat.
Trollocs are a power rod experiment, and they're still feared. Just because it's constructed by man doesn't mean that it's not awe-inspiring.
I guess. You just think it seems like it would be the other way around, that the Nim would be the ancient ones, you know, and the Ogier would be the more modern construct or something. But hey, what do I know? I can't tell you. But is there any equivalent in mythology that we know of to the Steading? Where'd that come
from? I'm sure that there were fields and such in Gaelic mythology where that were considered to be especially susceptible to random acts of fairy. Again, Andrew is our go-to guy for ancient mythology and knowing where to find the information at the very least.
Yeah, I'm looking.
Well, I know where to find it too. Just Google. Everything is Google anymore. You just Google everything.
It's odd because the Steading seem, at least to me, to be kind of a weird, like, anti-fairy ring.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that if you went into a fairy ring, the outside world passed you by, and if you ever exited... Actually, no, that makes perfect sense. I am completely wrong about that. For the Ogier, the Steading are very much the concept of a fairy ring, because the outside world passes by more quickly, and if you leave the Steading, you eventually get the longing and die. And if you leave the fairy ring, presumably enough time will have passed that all of the years you missed come crashing down on you and you die.
But I wouldn't think that a fairy ring would be considered a place of sanctuary, you know?
Oh, it really isn't.
No, it'd be a dangerous place, if anything.
Well, I don't necessarily know that there's a particular, a very particular, and I'm not really finding any parallels as well that connects them to any particular type of mythology or various supernatural phenomena that exist in previous storytelling tradition. like I said, as close as you come is pretty much the concept of the fairy ring, and even then it doesn't match very closely.
I don't know. It was a random thought. But can I sort of go back to the Heimdall and Loki thing? Loki?
Sure.
I had always thought that Loki was sort of the trickster, wasn't he?
He was, but he was also...
That, but that's more of a correlation to Matt than...
They also put Loki in the Matt category as being one of the people associated with Matt. The thing is Loki was the type of trickster who was mean for meanness sake.
Yeah.
It really does come down to that. I actually like the 13th Depository makes a number of different connections between various gods and different pantheons, including Su Wukong, who was the the Monkey King of Chinese mythology, which was hilarious, particularly because the Monkey King challenged the gods and, you know, was kind of that kind of just anti-establishment that really does kind of seem to strike a chord. The one I like more than... More than others, though, is the god and the culture hero who is very closely associated with him in Native American lore, that being Iktome and Coyote. Although I said them backwards. Just because they're wonderful, you know, tricksters, but it's more of a mischievous and impulsive sort of tricksterishness. You know, Matt doesn't really have that kind of bitter evil streak that is Loki. It is much more the idea, and a lot of the times, and I do have to put this out, particularly with Iktome, being a culture hero is different from being a god, in that culture heroes usually don't come out very well in the end of their stories. And Matt, at times, really kind of gets the short end of the stick, even in his own little escapades, a little bit. You know, it's always kind of, well, he's going to pay the cost, even though he won.
Well, you know, you said Matt doesn't have that mean, bitter streak. I immediately thought, well, wait till he's been really married to Juon for a little while. We'll see about that.
So Matt becomes Loki after the last battle?
I'm worried.
That's a frightening concept.
Fortuna has a lot of character flaws, shall we say. She could be a little bit...
Yeah, no friggin' kidding.
Yeah.
I would like to point out, too, that the 13th Depository notes in its section, talking about Coyote, that the god Raven is Coyote's rival in some stories, but in other parts of the U.S., Raven replaces Coyote as the divine trickster, and Matt is, of course, now the Prince of Ravens.
That's right. And, of course, I immediately had the flashback to the little story in X-Men Origins of Wolverine, you know, the moon and the, you know, the trickster and everything. And, of course, Cuckoo Choo got screwed, the ultimate quote.
Kamekuatsu.
Yeah, that's the one. Cuckoo
Choo.
I just love it. I see how Cuckoo Choo got screwed, didn't he? It's just like determined to not to be able to pronounce it.
I love it.
I could go on at length extolling.
He is really. I could go on at length extolling the acting virtues of Hugh Jackman, but that's all I've been podcasting for.
Yeah.
Extolling.
It was really weird because unfortunately it doesn't go back to Norse, which is probably a better thing that I don't mention it. But I found it really interesting that Coyote loses his eyes in a number of stories, including one where he, in order to impress women, was juggling his eyes, and he threw one of them so high it got stuck up in the sky and became a star.
Have a great view of the Earth.
And I was just thinking that then there's a parallel to one of Egwene's dreams where she sees Matt reaching up into the sky and grabbing a hold of stars and hurtling them to the earth and men dying all over the place.
I think he reached up and grabbed fireworks. It was fireworks. He reached up and grabbed one and it was like sparkling through his fist or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
I don't know. Are any of the ones where Coyote loses his eye, are any of them he loses it to a raven?
Or a fox?
No, a few of them, it ends up he gambles them away, which is hilarious.
Yeah, that's pretty much what he did. I'll see that.
Yeah.
He traded it away. That's not quite gambling, but pretty darn close with those people.
I never figured out what they wanted with it. What would they want with it? I mean, you know.
I think it was just the,
either the act of removal.
Yeah.
Or the fact that it's seen so much and somehow those feelings and impressions are burned on the back of the retina. I don't know.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I think
there's something about the phrase, it stings so much. It just, you know, I think of a sunburn as stinging so much. Sting is not the word I imagine with having my eye torn out of my head.
Yeah. I think we're talking an order of magnitude at least.
How is that?
More pain.
Stings.
It stings a little bit. Was that old commercial for Bactine removes the sting? That would be really painful. They even make this stuff anymore? Bactine. How about that?
See, the thing is, I personally would really like, rather than, you know, as cool as it would be for him to have, like, a sash over his eye, or, you know, his eye socket, because I think that would look a lot better than a patch, because we already have, what, 3 or 4 characters with patches over their eyes? Yeah,
we have
really,
at least Uno, who plays the patch perfectly. No one can top him in that, I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's like, you know, if he doesn't tie a sash over his eye, which would just look cooler, in my opinion, because I always think that the sash looks more cool than a patch, but then Matt should go and have a gemstone cut into the shape of an eye and replace it with a gem.
Yeah.
Imagine that, just having, like, a freaking, you know, like a ruby or, a, you know, an emerald or a sapphire or something, just...
So it looks like Mad-Eye Moody, then.
Well, but it wouldn't, like, roll around.
God. How do you know it wouldn't roll around? Ew.
Imagine going to visit the
Have you ever
of the
seen
Ravens
a person with a glass eye? It just sits there.
Going to visit the Prince of the Raven, and he has this... am I muted? Yeah, no. Going to visit the Prince of the Ravens, and he has this creepy ruby just sitting in his eye. You're not sure what to look at. Do you look at the real eye? Do you look at the ruby? The ruby's looking over your left shoulder. Some column behind you.
Personally, I would think a nice emerald or sapphire with a raven, like, carved right in the center
of
it.
Oh, yeah.
No. He's going to get the ruby from the dagger.
Oh, ew, God,
no.
No. It burns like hygiene.
We don't want any of Fane's taint or Majadar's taint in that. I'm good. Thank you.
Maybe that'll all get cleansed after the last battle and ran, you know.
I doubt it. Unfortunately.
Sends everything out, you know.
That's how it's going to end. If you didn't hear, I just slammed on my desk. I think I made people jump, but that's okay because I just had a sudden stroke of inspiration and it's amazing. Okay. That's how it's going to end. Rand is going to kill the Dark One, and then Fane is going to take his place.
He certainly has lots of supernatural connections, I guess it could.
Well, in order for the boar to be able to steal itself, not only does the seal have to get out of the way, but the Dark One's going to have to be pushed out of the way. Best way to do that, kill him, and then throw someone who doesn't quite have his mass yet into the boar to seal it. Then he's sealed on the outside, and we're all good.
Hmm. I can see a few little problems with that. So who is Padan Fane in Norse mythology? That's what I want to know. I guess he could be Loki. He's pretty bitter. He's definitely mean.
But when you said...
But there's nothing like Mashadar. Go ahead.
When you said, when you said, Andrew, about the carve a raven into the emerald, I had an idea for some reason, or I saw in my head... You know, I don't know if either of you have been watching the new NBC series, The Cape, but...
I haven't been able to.
Neither do I. I watch it on Hulu, which I know you can't
broadband connection.
Yeah.
I don't...
Anyway.
Oh, crap.
But the main villain has a split personality, and when he's in his public personality, he's fine, but when he's in his creepy evil personality, he literally has chess pieces in his eyeballs, as his eyeballs.
Ew.
It's creepy. I mean, it's the shape of chess pieces that take over the pupil and the iris, and then there's white around it, but it's absolutely creepy.
That's pretty bizarre. I'm still trying to think of who we could find to play Perrin. I don't think we can think of anybody with a sufficiently godlike physique.
Yeah, I can't think of anyone young enough who would still look good with the beard and the big burly.
He looks really good with a beard, but I don't know if he's burly enough, you know.
Well, yeah, the young and big enough, I think of, strangle me if you must, but I think of the guy who plays Emmett Cullen in the Twilight films. The fact that I know his name is slightly disconcerting, but not really.
That is really, really disconcerting. I didn't know you were
not really. I enjoyed
vampires.
Books. I don't enjoy the movies. I enjoy the books, and I will proudly wave my I enjoy the Twilight books flag, okay? The movies can die in a hole. But,
movies were all right.
But no, the kid who plays Emmett Cullen has the stature. I just don't like his face as Perrin's face. I can't see his face being Perrin. Wouldn't work for me.
See, you know what they need to do? They need to get a young and upcoming actor, and they need to cast him now. And then they need to go and take him between now and when the movie is made and stick him in a forge and just have him forge it, you know, Revolutionary War, you know, his, you know, medieval war recreation type stuff, and just stick him in a smithy and have him smith for like the 5 or 6 years until we finally get a, you know, Wheel of Time movie, and then he'll be perfect. As a matter of fact, cast him young now. Like, cast somebody right now who isn't capable of growing a beard, so that by the time they cast the Wheel of Time movie and actually start shooting, he'll have been forged up and bearded up enough to be able to play Perrin.
I don't think they'd make him be a smith.
So get a 12-year-old?
Yeah, they just pump him up on steroids or something for the next few years. That's what they do. They wouldn't waste all that time having to learn how to be a smith.
If you put him in a smithy, then he's character, you know, locked, and he's thinking about what.
Yeah,
he's got the right character.
The problem is, if you put him in a blacksmith shop now, a smithy now, unless it's a faithful recreation I hesitate to use the word ancient, but an older style smithy. I mean, they're not going to have a need for a bellows blower, and so he's not going to gain as much muscle mass. I mean, there's still some. Those heavers are hammy. Did I just say those heavers are hammy? I did. Those hammers are heavy, and so he'll definitely gain some strength and definition there, and knowledge of how to work the metal.
That's what I mean. French and Indian War, Revolutionary War, and Medieval War recreations. In those, you would have a big bellows on the forge. I've actually known people who had them.
Yep.
Creepy people. That's because you're an NCA.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, the recreation societies, they're freaking smiths all over the place.
Yes, but they create Mulliner.
They could smith you a big warhammer. I didn't tell you that. I actually just want to look up one of my old smith friends and have him smith me a hook.
Yes.
Or a bopper. Just a nice, decent looking hook that I could use as a rigid offhand parry.
Anyone have any last comments to add to the discussion of the parallels between the three main boys, the boy characters, and the Norse gods or any other gods?
We could go on for quite a while. We specifically refrained from bringing in too many.
Another episode.
Yeah. I think probably the best way to wrap it up is by saying we have gone a little far afield from the email that Patrick sent in, where he was specifically talking about three Norse gods in comparison to the three boys. But we have also been very restrained in what we've been talking about. There's so much more that we could talk about of the character parallels of each of the boys. In fact, each of the different characters in any mythology, in history in general. And so I'm hoping that at some point in time, maybe we'll be able to actually do some series of episodes where we're talking about, where we go more in depth into each of these. I mean, we have a tendency, because we want to talk about so much, that we only skim the surface of stuff. And so sometime if we could just delve in deep, it would be great.
Well, I have to say, I myself actually learned a lot from not only Patrick's email, but Andrew's, you know, contribution to it, because I was not at all up on Norse mythology. I knew some slight parallels, but no idea that the parallels were so, you know, in depth and pervasive. So it was a learning experience for me too.
We obviously, of course, like I said, we've used a little bit of Wikipedia and some various other sources, and that one of the really big ones, of course, is the 13th Depository. Their website is 13, the number, so 13depository.blogspot.com, and the 13th Depository is just a wonderful, wonderful resource. Definitely encourage everybody to go and check it out if you're looking for, you know, various theories or just information, you know, general things. Like I said, they had pages on various herbs that appear in the Wheel of Time and their connection to real or, you know, other fictionalized plants. And, you know, there's just so much on the site that it's a wonderful, wonderful site. And hopefully we will also at some point in the future be able to run through the various Wheel of Time community sites in a podcast, because we have so many good sites that provide us with information and support and places where people can just get together and talk about, you know, the series in various different ways. So yes, definitely check out the 13th Depository. So yes, thanks to the 13th Depository and Linda, who is the head honcho there.
All right, so I think that's definitely going to wrap up our episode on the parallels between Matt Rand and Perrin and the gods of mythology. Thank you for joining us. We always appreciate everybody who listens. We hope you have as much fun listening to this as we do recording it.
There are a number of ways you can get a hold of us if you'd like to. You can, of course, call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
Oh, they'd like to get a hold of us. They probably beat us senseless.
Get your hands off me.
You can also reach us via our email, which is podcast@dragonmount.com. Usually one or more of us will answer an email, sometimes within mere minutes, other times within a day. We always enjoy hearing from you.
And, of course, you can go to our website to find links to our archives and our pages on various social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter by going to dragonmount.com/podcast.
So this is Virginia in Data Light Illumina until we meet again.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravyanen Toman Shima, Taisha Day.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. To contact us, visit our website, DragonMount.com/podcast.
I forgot where we were. Okay, I
could do it. It'll light illumine you until the rest of your days or whatever.
I don't know about meeting again.
Uravya se intone anshima me aishite te.
Aishite
te.
This is the official nader of the Fourth Age podcast. We have now hit the all-time low.
Oh, pshaw.